Welcome back to Arts About.
Show about art that's a work of art in itself. Bonjour, man.
Bonjour, Jean. Bonjour, Céline.
Arts About is, of course, brought to you by the generosity of the McClelland Sculpture Park and Gallery and facilitated by the Bendigo Bank Studio. I'm Sally Bailey. You're here in the Artable P Studios with me and Artist in Residence and Cultural Sounding Board, John Baird. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
And the always fascinating Mark Stewart.
Good morning, everyone.
Brody Gouzet is on, keeping us on topic, on time and on the airwaves, as usual. What have you got for us this week, John?
Well, I'm going to continue the conversation about my studios and reckless behaviour.
Great. That's on
theme.
They
all seem to accommodate.
Yes. Fabulous. Looking forward to that. What about you, Mark?
Oh, a bit of a mix of art and technology and the future.
We're going to leap around from century to century? Or?
Well, no, we're going to get really angry about a few things.
Good. Oh, that's great.
We love it.
Yeah, we do.
I'm on a short leash today.
Why?
Well, I didn't bring my headphones.
Yes.
I had to borrow a set, and it's only got a little wire on it.
It has too.
And I feel like I'm kind of leashed to the desk somewhat.
Here you are.
I'm also a little concerned.
Oh, are you? Why?
Because Brody rather recklessly invited me behind the curtain to have a look at the knobs and dials, and it's freaking me out a bit what goes on over there.
Oh.
I'm apparently going to learn how to do it.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, but I'm worrying about it.
Don't worry. It'll be all right.
Are you going to be controlling me somehow, John?
That's my plan.
Oh, my God.
Okay. Yeah, watch out. This is what's going to happen when I'm away in a couple
of
weeks.
I'm looking forward to it.
I'm going to be talking about Away, which is on at the Malthouse Theatre, directed by its artistic director, Matthew Luton. And, surprise, surprise, we're blessed this week to have the wonderful Cliff Ellen revisiting us.
Fabulous.
He's going to be steering the end of the show with his view from the cliff. So to take us into a little musical revelry before we start, here's one of the most influential guitarists from the Roots musical revival era. Her fingerpicking style was a great inspiration to many who followed her. She was born in North Carolina in the late 1800s. Here's Elizabeth Cotton with Freight Train.
That was great.
It's gorgeous, wasn't it?
When was that recorded, do you reckon?
Oh, I don't know, but it would have been in the early 1900s. Early, 30s, thereabouts.
Well, it's a good recording.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah.
Probably been re-digitalised, John.
Yeah, probably has, actually.
The song has also been re-recorded by Joe Henry and Billy Bragg on their Railway
now?
Songs album.
Oh, yes, I do know that album too, but I haven't. I didn't put two and two together. Hey, I went along this week and saw Away at the Malthouse. And it's a play directed by Matthew Luton, who's also the artistic director down there. And it's fabulous. I had never seen Away before, but apparently it is a much-loved classic of Australian writing written by Michael Gow. But from chatting with the cast afterwards, he's done some rather interesting things with it. And I really enjoyed it. It was a great play. It focuses on the sort of archetypal Australian, characters of the 1960s, and it sort of focuses around three families that meet after the school play at the end of the year, and which happens to be a Shakespeare play called, Midsummer Night's Dream. So that opens the play. And although it's kind of about...
You mean Shakespeare's play opens the play?
Yeah, like Shakespeare's play opens the play. A school production of Midsummer Night's Dream opens the play. And then we meet these three families that are all sort of slightly different in their demographics, I suppose. And they're all going off on holidays, and what we see really is these three families' similarities, I guess, in a way. The play explores tiny cracks in their family relationships and how they can split under the stress of a holiday. We've all seen those things.
Holidays are stressful.
They are stressful.
That's when most
Christmas days. And
yes,
things
a lot
like
of
that.
Men have heart attacks during holidays.
Do they?
Because they're actually de-stressing from working, and then they're re-stressing with their children and their wives.
And all of those little undercurrents. Well, that's what this play kind of explores, and how dangerous
holidays
those things
are. No good.
Are.
Shouldn't take. Japanese only have 2 weeks holiday a year.
So it's set in the mid-60s, and Michael Gow, he top-and-tailed it actually with Shakespeare. So there's a Midsummer Night's Dream at the very beginning, mm-hmm. and there is a quote from King Lear at the very end. And within the text, Matthew Luton has really played up the parallels with Shakespeare, because you know that idea with all the most Shakespeare plays, they look at how small ideas, small things in human frailties, how that can actually be the thing that causes the great breakup or causes the great drama in the play, is actually down to something that's really basically a simple human quality.
Right.
And in a way, that's what happens in this play, in that they are these three families. They all have terrible things to deal with in one way or another, and yet their lives are ordinary and they're suburban, and they're one's off to the Gold Coast, one's off to the middle of New South Wales, and the other one is off on a driving holiday somewhere. But ultimately, they all come together again. It's amazing. The characters are all archetypes. You know, there's some great laughs because there's some lines from your childhood that we've all heard our principal say or a mother say or whatever. So, and there's some sort of hilarity in all of that. And yet really it's a very poignant and sad story about how those burdens, those emotional burdens, can kind of...
Where did you see this?
At the Malthouse.
Oh, okay.
So right. And so the guy who's the director of it, Matthew Luton, is also the artistic director of the Malthouse. And I'd never seen any of his plays. But, from talking with them, with the cast afterwards, he's really played around with it because all these sort of surrealist scenes from Midsummer Night's Dream come back through the play, and there's all this kind of surreal dancing and so on that occurs and kind of echoes this Shakespearean atmosphere in it. Well, not even atmosphere, but message, I guess. Anyway, staging simple, stylized.
Who are the actors?
Heather Mitchell plays the lead, or she plays one of the leads. Actually, they're all terrific. I haven't got a list of them, of all the names down here. I probably should, but. The cast are wonderful, all really great. And the thing that is just incredible, you sit there, you're watching this play, it's on a very stylized, simple set, and then halfway through the production, the set just changes so dramatically in front of your eyes. It is one of those moments where everybody in the theatre just is open, slack-jawed, open mouth. Oh, my God, I didn't expect that.
Oh, I love a bit of good set work.
Oh, it was fabulous. Mm. Anyway.
And they manifest that by... just turning things around or taking everything off the stage. And
because it finishes tonight, it's probably not a spoiler for anybody. Basically, the set sandwiches. So all the action's on the top of the set and you're looking at it. And then all of a sudden, like an oyster shell, it opens like that.
Okay.
With the doorway in the centre and the cast come back through. It's really, really brilliant. It's really fabulous. So Malthouse Theatre, it's just doing great things. Clearly Matthew Luton's an inspired man. His programming is terrific. It's probably too late for anybody to get down and see Away, but go and have a look at the Malthouse. It
might come back.
Yeah. Well, it will too, because it's a play that is an old favourite, and his reinterpretation of it,
right,
by all accounts, is quite unusual.
Go to the theatre much, Mark?
Concerts more. I saw a very, very good piano concert played by a Canadian woman on Friday night. It was lovely. Mm. Theatre, I like, but not that often. Not as often as I would like.
Mm.
I really want to see the South Park one, the Mormon, what was it called?
Yes.
The South Park one.
What's it called? The Art of Mormon. No, what is it called?
The Book of Mormon.
The Book of Mormon.
Yeah.
Yes, I'd quite like to see that too. That's apparently hilarious. Yeah. Yes.
I don't go to the theatre. I've misplaced my tuxedo jacket.
And you don't need a tuxedo jacket to go to the theatre.
Well,
not unless you go to the art centre, to some sort of premiere opening of something fancy, where everybody's dresses up. But really,
remind me a little bit of Pirandello, when he does a play within a play.
Yes.
Six actors in a play, one of them. It's brilliant the way that they sort of go in and out of being in the play and in reality. And this
is it a French play?
Pirandello's Italian.
Italian.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it a musical or is it an opera?
No, yeah. It's a theatre. I'll look it up and speak about it next week.
Yeah, that'd be good. I'd be interested in that. I also wanted to just briefly ask John what he thought about $110 million for Basquiat's painting at Sotheby's.
A lot of money for a basket.
It is. It is a lot of money for a basket.
I think it's... I have problems with it, Sally, is what actually happens for me. I think that, as you know, I have trouble with the huge swing tag on art.
Mm.
And I'm not a fan of Basquiat anyway. And I don't think it's helpful in any way at all to have people spending those sorts of sums of money on
Other people's paintings. If they were spending on his paintings, he'd be probably quite happy.
Yeah.
I think it's great. I think it's wonderful. Idiots are spending so much money on these paintings, which are probably worth about $10,000. Basquiat, I think, as opposed to John, he was a brilliant painter.
I really like his work.
I think he's great. I think he's being milked by everybody since he died. He's 27 of a heroin overdose because he couldn't stand it anymore himself. It's a shame in many ways, but that's the way it goes. It happened to Vincent. Happens to a lot of people.
Yes, he had some of the thing that you complain about, Mark, is that he was a member of a minority group in the art world.
Very true. Very true.
And supported, perhaps, as a result.
Well, I think in retrospect that he went beyond that. He definitely went beyond that. He became a real... He is a real painter, as far as I'm concerned. But lucky for him, he was black. He was actually half and half, I think. His father was a doctor. He was a middle-class boy. He wasn't some poor kid from the streets.
He's often described as a street artist, which...
he started off... I think he began as a graffiti artist, didn't he?
He did.
Kids do.
Well, that's right. Yeah, okay. Okay, fair enough. Well... I think now it's time for That's Amazing, I Never Knew That.
I'm on already.
Okay. Oh, yes, I forgot to tell you, we've changed the order today.
This is the fourth movement of the Fourth Symphony. Just lovely. That's it?
Yep.
Beautiful.
Does that put you in a good mood?
Oh, it always does. It takes me back and forward.
To where, who knows where?
Mangrove Mountain, actually.
Mangrove Mountain? Where's Mangrove Mountain?
Mangrove Mountain's about 60 kilometres north of Sydney, about sort of east of, Gosford.
Yes.
And Brett Whiteley and his sister owned a house there. And I lived there for about 2 years in the middle of the 70s. It was a magnificent spot.
Wow. Okay.
So, all right, to begin with, to continue with Basquiat, I think the price for that painting is doesn't really change anything, finally, does it?
Doesn't change anything, but it doesn't improve my opinion of that whole process, of money and art. And I don't struggle with the connection. I'm perfectly happy for people to invest in art. And for art to be a vehicle for people's money, but the sums are too large.
I agree. I think the sums actually mean that it just creates a huge division between art and that process, because it's nothing to do with the art that is on that canvas. It's actually to do with it being a commodity or becoming a commodity.
People are aware of the swing tag more than the art. The story. In fact, that makes more sense than any other, I think, when we're talking about this, is the Mr. Geffen, who bought a Klimt painting and then resold it for millions and millions of dollars profit and never actually looked at the painting.
No.
Couldn't describe it.
No, but that's often the case. I mean, it has always been the case, John. It's always been a commodity. since antique times.
Yeah. I don't mind it being a commodity.
And it doesn't really matter how much they're paying. It doesn't change the painting at all, does it? It doesn't really change it's only a question, it's only the money, which is completely separate from the painting.
Mm.
Mm.
Now, I had a question. Did you find any political art?
I did find some political art.
And what was it?
Well, I found a huge list of different things, actually, that were, on top of Guernica.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's Banksy. Pussy Riot, Ai Weiwei?
Banksy's is separate. He's not involved. Well, I guess he is involved in the art market in a way. Pussy Riot, they got dealt with very quickly by Mr. Putin.
Yeah, but that doesn't discount the fact that what were they being political about? Well, they were disagreeing with the regime. They were critical and vocal about their non-alignment with what's going on.
I think they were put into jail mostly because they were singing in a church. I think that was more to do where they were singing their song mm-hmm. than what they were singing about. I think you'll find. But look, that's Pussy Riot, as far as I'm concerned, a very minor sort of political move.
I did was look and think, well, I mean, you made a remark last week.
I mean about political art is something which is political at the time and continues to be political in the future.
Oh, yes, this okay, is the fair problem. Enough.
You
okay.
can be political in its time. And Guernica was, in a way, but it took him a long time to actually make the painting.
Mm.
And it really goes beyond Guernica. It in itself is a brilliant painting.
Do you know the apocryphal story about Guernica, Mark?
About the act or the painting?
About Picasso making the painting and the German officers going into his studio to have a look around at the great Picasso and what he was up to. And,
which we must forget, he was in Paris the whole of the occupation.
And one of them looked at Guernica on the wall while Picasso was working on it, and he said, "Did you do that?" And Picasso said, "No, you did."
Good comeback.
Not bad, huh? I like that. Yeah. Pablo was tough.
Yeah, he was a tough
boy.
He
must have been to stay in Paris the whole of the occupation. And you did mention off before Ai Weiwei.
Yes.
Who for me, I don't know if you saw his show with Andy Warhol.
Yes.
I thought was the biggest load of marketing crap I've seen in a very long time, starting with those absurd bicycles, which apparently he was told he had to fill up in a big empty space, and so he decided to put all these aluminium bicycles together.
I thought it was a beautiful thing, actually.
I thought it was ugly as hell. But,
did you?
You know, that's where we all have different ideas. Mm. I think compared to Marcel Duchamp's wheel on the forks put on a stool is an infinitely more beautiful thing than anything that Ai Weiwei can come up with. Now, the problem with Ai Weiwei for me is that he has been around for quite a while.
Yeah.
This political idea that he's under some sort of threat from the Chinese is just absolute crap. He was kept in his studio. He couldn't leave the country.
Well, his passport was removed.
His passport was removed.
And why was that?
Well, because he was considered to be a bit of a problem.
Subversive.
But, I mean, how has he been subversive? Can you tell me?
Well, no, but by being critical of the government of the time.
But how does that affect us?
Well, how does it affect us? Well, it alerts us to the fact that that is actually going on in that country.
We knew it already.
Well, yes,
this
we
is
did,
what
but
I think about. About the artist like Ai Weiwei. He's riding on something which exists already and which none of us are going to change. Absolutely, none of us can. We can say we can think about it and talk about it and say, oh, how bad the Chinese are. Not looking at ourselves. You know, this is something which I realized during the global financial crisis in Europe in 2008, speaking to a Spanish guy saying, Jesus, things are bad in Spain, aren't they? And he said, well, no, things are much worse in France. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, in our papers, they're talking about France being a real basket case and, you know, Spain's not so bad. And I realized that France is doing the same thing, and each country speaks about the other country as being really bad, whereas in fact, it's just pure propaganda. Mm-hmm. And this is why I think someone like Ai Weiwei works on this propaganda aspect of his own fame, and he gets, you know, taken around, oh, yes.
I'm not a big fan either, Mark, but there was an object in that show, which was a large column from a Chinese temple, which was piercing some furniture, some like antique furniture, and it was touted as a political object, as a political remark of some sort.
Mm.
I struggled to see it as a political remark, and I'm sure that the Chinese government would have struggled to see it as a political remark unless it was. They were told that that's what it was, but it was a beautifully crafted thing.
Yes, I don't remember seeing that.
No, it was huge. It was
on the ground. It was on the ground.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I do. The pots, you know, those 2,000-year-old Ming pots.
Oh, yeah.
I think that he, you know, he videoed himself breaking as they were falling. You know, they breaking on the ground. and the other ones which he painted, I just found it just a, you know, there's no real
didn't
significance but behind it. There's no didn't spirit really do anything behind for me. It. It's all about him.
Right.
Okay. So that's. Have you got any more political?
No, no. I think I think we've done that. Let's move on because you've got stuff we want to talk about.
Well,
too,
the other one was what's his name, Damien Hirst.
Oh yes, absolutely.
Who's a lovely man, by the way.
Is
very, very nice. Gave up cocaine and alcohol at the age of 36, and his art has gone downhill ever since, basically. But this latest exhibition he's done
at the Venice Biennale.
At the Venice Biennale, which are both in the French billionaires, I forget his name, escapes me, who owns both the Palazzo Grazzi and the other place.
So that's the Christie's man.
He owns also Christie's as well, yes. I forget his name. He's a concert pianist, a very, very sort of concentrated dynamo of a man. Also a multi-billionaire, also a big investor in Damien Hirst. Mm-hmm. So he has put up this exhibition and funded this for Damien to keep up his prices, basically. So Damien, as we all know, couldn't draw himself out of a bath and doesn't know how to make a sculpture.
Not that good at stuffing a shark either.
Well, no.
Oh, phone crime, Brody.
That's Damien.
Damien must have been listening.
Famous, he loves the show. He's unfortunately, he's the sort of person, when he initially started, they'd sit around a table, about 14, these young Englishmen, a bit like Bansky, snorting cocaine and drinking vodka and coming up with ideas. And we'll do that. And so he'd get all these ideas into action. Some of those circular paintings that he's taken from roto reliefs of Marcel Duchamp, he's made some beautiful paintings with this process. Just magnificent. But he's whipping them out. So he's actually destroying himself by his capacity.
And what about there's a bit of a furor going on at the moment
about these sculptures
that are in the Venice Biennale.
Yes, it's not this James guy who put the sculptures in.
Jason de Carreis, Taylor.
The famous sculptor who put them into the Granada underground, and they've all been covered by coral. I remember in Arles seeing in a person's apartment some marble sculptures, Roman sculptures, which had been picked up from the river, the Rhone River, off the ground, had been there for the last two, they'd fallen off a boat and been there for 2,000 years, and they had the watermarks going through the marble face.
Wow.
And they were set up like this, and they had a light on top, and you could just see the water flowing through the marble. It's something which has been seen before. The antiquities, people started collecting things off the ground, they realised the beauty of them. So they're both doing something which has been done before.
As people do.
Yes.
But Damien is unfortunately riding on, he doesn't make any of these things, and you can see that's what Tom Wolfe, the
I wouldn't
American
have put
writer,
Damien
calls
Hirst
hands off.
In the political arena at all. I think he's driven by commerce.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's no politics in him. We're just moving on to the fact that he's considered, it's a marketing act, basically, what he's doing in Venice.
Yeah, and I didn't like the look of them, those undersea things from Hirst. With they're kind of sculptures with bits of coral glued to them.
Yeah, that's right. That's what they look like, didn't they?
And the sculptures themselves have absolutely no integrity. To really make a figurative sculpture demands a lot of... it's not just an artisan with a compass and a five-axis computer machine you can do that. It really takes a lot of effort, a lot of work. And this is the same with Jeff Koons. You look at his stuff and you can see it's just industrially made. There's no... there's not that...
I thought it was interesting that our guest last week, Kylie... made the remark that when people suggest to her that her work was mechanically made, that she took that as a compliment.
Yes.
She was a smart girl. She's sort of like a duck. You could say whatever you like and just rub water off a duck's back and just go completely off it. She wasn't going to be affected by it, which I think is a wonderful... Wish I could be like that.
Right. You're not like that. I've tried. And
he reacts.
It sticks.
But listen, how much time do we have?
We've got a minute or so.
Okay, so I just want to move on to that advertising giant Google, who've come up with a new technology, which is a world-class virtual art exhibition with priceless masters adorning every wall of a classroom under the ambitious plan by Google. You'll be able to place a virtual 3D model of the Colosseum or Michelangelo's David on every desk so that students can walk around it and study it from every angle. So it's going to be like holograms.
Right.
And you'll be able to study anything you like within 3D. Now, just I can see your eyes fluttering there, Sally.
It's you, Mark. I can't help myself.
Oh, this is it, the augmented reality. Now, you know the difference between augmented reality and virtual reality?
Hyperrealism.
Well, augmented reality is like the Pokemon. They put an image into a real area.
Oh, this Pokemon Go thing.
Which happened a couple of months ago. This is going to be very big in the future for everybody. For example...
Will we have to wear masks or goggles?
The VR outfit, you have to wear them. They've got a long way to go, but... you'll be able to select a coffee table in an online store from a catalogue and using augmented reality, virtually place it in your lounge room to see if it fits and it matches the decor.
I can't bear it.
They can then buy it if they wish. You'll be able to do the same thing with clothes. You'll have a virtual mannequin. I don't know who it'll be, maybe Brad Pitt or...
You'll probably be able to determine its sizing. You'll probably be able to create your own mannequin that is of your size and then see the clothes on
And you can put your
them.
Clothes on them and then you can decide whether you want to buy them. And then if you're with Amazon, they'll send out a drone. You just have to put the welcome mat out in your backyard if you
just
have
Just don't try and put a cup of coffee on the coffee table.
No. And the drone will come and it will deliver your outfit within an hour.
Oh, it's all going to pot, everybody. I think we better move on. I think it's very good that we have finite lives and we're all going to be dead soon.
This drone delivery thing, I don't get, you know, like little drones flying around with parcels hanging underneath them.
The skies are going to be filled with them.
Well,
and people will just take them.
Shoot them.
What, take the drones?
Yeah, they won't be able to.
They'll be move away from them. They're going to be controlled. They'll have cameras on them. People can't just take somebody who has a camera. They're under surveillance. I mean, there's a new film I must talk about quickly.
You wear a mask.
We've got no time. You can mention
I'll
be, it. Maybe
I'll butt in when John's talking.
Okay, terrific. Well, we better go to a message from our sponsors while we get ourselves organised to listen to you, John.
Okay. Thank you, Swanee.
Still in his galaxy?
Yeah,
in
he's still in
a galaxy,
his galaxy
far, far away.
Not that far.
No, not that far actually at the moment, but it might go somewhere. I was talking last week about the studio in the church in Richmond.
Yes.
And sometime before that, I had a different studio in Melbourne in Little Bourke Street, just up from the corner of Hardware Lane. In a building that's now legal offices, and I had the top floor there, and this is the building that I used to be able to take the car upstairs.
I was just going to say, is it that one?
Yeah, yes. So I could take the Volkswagen upstairs in the lift.
Yeah, which is handy.
Yeah. And
he's probably sleeping in it.
Sleeping in the car. I had the building had a rooftop, not a rooftop garden, but a kind of a rooftop walkway around a parapet around the top of it, you know, so you can get up there and have a look around. But in order to get there, you have to walk across a bit of roofing, and there was a large aluminium, plank, part of a scaffolding sort of arrangement that had been put up there for you to walk across. And I had a party one night. What's going on here?
We're shuffling chairs because Cliff's going to come in a second. Sorry about that.
You could walk across this scaffolding on the roof to, rather than sort of crash through the tin.
Mm.
I had a party there one night. A lot of us ended up on the roof of the building. And we got this bit of aluminium scaffolding and attached some ropes to one end of it, sent a couple of characters over the road to the hardware building and, in fact, the hardware club.
Oh, yes, I remember the hardware club.
Over the lane. And they got up on the roof and we threw them some ropes and we dragged this aluminium plank so that it was positioned from my building over to the hardware club to the bar.
Ideal.
An open window, you know, into the bar.
That is great.
And the plan was, of course, to make a thoroughfare from where we were into the hardware club bar. And I think the plan was, in fact, to pick up some chicks and bring them back.
Of course, that was the plan.
Yeah. But it didn't seem like anyone there was willing to actually undergo the journey. Except for one young fellow, a Frenchman, as it turns out, Mark, who headed across this thing into the bar. And he came back about maybe half an hour, 40 minutes later, not with girls, but with Hugo Race, of all people, who made his way across the...
Who's Hugo Race?
Hugo Race was a musician who was in Nick Cave's band at the time.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And so he came back and joined the party for a while. But he gave me a bit of advice.
Mm-hmm.
He said to me, John, if you want to pick up girls in a nightclub, don't complicate the issue.
That is good advice.
Yeah.
That is good advice.
Apparently girls prefer staircases and doors.
Yeah, as if girls are going to come back over a plank between two buildings. What, three stories up? How many stories up were you?
About five.
It's not going to happen, is it?
And you remember the hardware club, Sally?
What, yeah, great, I do remember the hardware club.
What a great thing that was.
Oh, yeah. Remember the hairdos?
Yeah, I remember all of it. And in fact,
hairdos and big shirts, big loose shirts.
This was the 80s, was it?
Yeah.
Mm. I solved the problem of being able to get into the hardware club or not by simply joining the hardware club.
Right.
The actual hardware club cost me $20 for a membership.
Yeah.
And then they could keep me out of the building.
Brilliant. I didn't know that.
Yeah, you could do that.
Gosh.
Now, what did you have, Mark? You had something that you were aiming right at me.
That's right. He was accusing me, reminding me that I had accused him of being a Luddite before.
A Luddite.
And he had a comeback for me.
Yes, well, the Luddites were not afraid of technology, in fact.
Were they not?
No, they weren't. It's a misinterpretation.
So
they were actually smashing machines because that was the only way they could get the employer's attention.
Oh.
They weren't against the machines in themselves. They were against the low wages they were getting paid for actually working the machines.
This is in the UK, is it?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, in the end of the 19th century.
And it was Luddites were from Ludd?
John Ludd was his name.
Ah.
He was the leader.
Well, I don't know. I didn't know where the word came from. Brody's just... Brody can't contain himself.
That was a talk for next week. I wanted to speak about this film called The Circle, which is worth seeing.
It's not a Julian Schnabel movie, is it?
No, but you should see the Julian Schnabel movie about that, Basquiat. It's really worth seeing.
Okay,
it's
a we'll
very
have a look
beautiful
at
movie. Really, quite beautiful. This one's about, it's taken from a book written by a man called Dave Eggers, and it's about Facebook and Google and everyone sort of taking over, basically.
Is it an English film or what?
It's an American film.
American.
But have you read Zadie Smith?
Yeah, nope. I have. I've read one of her books. Her second book I just couldn't
hack.
No.
No?
I couldn't, it was the form was so different that I just found myself rereading and rereading and rereading and just losing it.
Okay, well, she's talking about...
White Tooth or something.
Yes, that was the first one.
Yeah, that's the one I read.
Apparently it's quite good.
It was.
Anyway, she's writing about Facebook, and she says that she's dreaming of a web that caters to a kind of person who no longer exists, a private person, a person who is a mystery to the world and, which is more important, to herself. Person is mystery. I like that. As opposed to everyone sharing, and she says you have to be someone before you can start sharing.
Yes, it's true. There's an awful lot of dross out there on Facebook, that's for sure. Hey, The Circle, though, what's
It's a movie with it's about this book.
It's about Zadie Smith's book, is it?
Yeah, no. Well, no, this is about Dave Eggers. Yeah, Dave Eggers' novel is what the film is based on. It's from 2013. It's with Tom Hanks and Emma Watson. And it's about social network and how it can take over people's lives. And well, they're saying that Facebook's latest app is the one where people are killing each other. People are filming themselves killing kids.
Oh, yes, there was a big discussion about whether or not Facebook was responsible for...
The live video, And people are videoing themselves killing other people or their kids.
Nice.
Anything to be famous.
Right. Now, you've got a lot of bits of paper over there, Mark. You're shuffling them around. More paper than the man sitting next to me.
Hey, I think you're all overlooking the fact that our elder has entered the room.
He would be the man.
Revered elder, actor, blogger, critic Cliff Allen has returned today to present us with some of his canny observations. Good morning, Cliff. Welcome back to Arts About. We've missed you.
Good morning, Sally. All right. No point missing me. Oh. I'm just an old pensioner.
You're looking younger though, Cliff.
Yeah, he does.
Bad
look
eyesight. And,
you do look good as the holiday.
Dreadful, what is it, a tremor in the hand? I can't even pick up a bit of paper on a reference.
How about a glass of wine?
Yeah, that would help.
A beer.
Apparently alcohol's good, according to the doctor.
Yeah.
The first half of the beer is a bit shaky, but after that it's really good.
Oh, well then have right. a beer.
That's right. In point of fact, I went to Baja last night. God help me.
He's such a groover.
Who would go to Baja?
Why did you go to Baja? Your grandson was playing in a band.
Larry was in the band there. Actually, he was warming up with a beer. They have these huge glasses of beer. And it was terrible, you know. Oh. I mean, it was full of 20-year-olds.
Mm.
A lot of females, all dressed the same. Very dark sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. How are they dressed? Sorry, that interests me.
Dark.
Dark. Gothic. Goth, you mean?
Non-individualistic, if you like.
Well, there's not a lot of that in this country. Sorry.
It's not like my day, and the music's so heavy, you can hardly speak.
Mm.
You come away with a sore throat because you've been screaming just to speak to somebody. Look, I did the band. I took a few pictures and so on.
What's the band
away.
Called?
I don't know.
Louis's band.
This is why people take their phones.
I don't know, Louis on the guitar.
They text each other.
And he's super cool.
Of course he is.
Always dressed well and has these weird haircuts and so on. And
how old's he now?
He's about 22. He hasn't got any spikes in his nose or his ears.
That's good.
Otherwise.
Got any tats?
I don't know. I'm not going to ask him. I don't want to see his body. He's a grandson. Anyway, it's frightening. But what do we talk about?
Yeah, I don't know. What's been going on? Seen any good?
Well, I was a bit upset about the crit by Cameron Woodhead on My Fair Lady. He came in and said, I forget what he said. See, I've got to read my notes.
That's all right.
But, what was it? No, red carpet, personalities. I wasn't invited, by the way, the opening night.
Where's it on at?
It's on at the Regent, which is a terrible theatre.
Yeah.
I saw it 50 years ago at Her Majesty's, but he was talking about the misogyny and the class prejudice behind the lyrics, which are more galling over the passing years. And I just think that's ridiculous. My Fair Lady, which is, Lerner and Lowe, who wrote it, that bloke in England?
Bernard Shaw
wrote it. It's a beautiful play, a musical, if you like. You know I don't like musicals, but I always thought it was lovely. And he carries on about a couple of people came in on the Age letters agreeing to his interpretation. And how childish is that?
I know, this is the problem, is that everything is being put under some sort of political correct microscope.
Yeah.
And, Eliza wins. I think there are more important things to be going on about, perhaps.
But Eliza wins in the end. That's what gets me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it is a tale about a misanthrope who enforces his value system on a lowly flower girl. But
Why can't a woman be like a man? We've done that,
haven't we? Didn't we know that already? And isn't it?
Well, therefore, you would expect some misanthropic behaviour.
Exactly.
I think it's fun. That's all. Marina Pryor, what's she in? Hello, Dolly, the production company. Wouldn't recommend that actually. Stage Art proudly presents a Victorian professional premiere of the, that's the point, the Tony Award-winning Spring Awakening. It's a musical. It's on Chapel Off Chapel. Good reports. That finishes on June 16th or thereabouts.
A couple of weeks, yeah.
And only costs $50 to $80. But it's about poignancy and passion. and it's illuminating and it's unforgettable.
Oh, okay.
And so on and so forth.
Are you going to go and see it?
No, look, I've had a couple of people talk to me on Facebook saying it's really good.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm not going up the chapel off chapel.
Right.
I filled up my car today at Mornington.
Yeah.
Do you know the last time I filled it up?
No.
Last time I came here.
Oh, my goodness me.
That's how many Ks I do.
So you've been taking it quite quietly back at home, haven't you?
Very quietly. I look up at my phone and it'll tell me how many steps I've done.
Mm.
I think on last Sunday I did 609.
So it's about 300 to the RSL.
No, it's about 250. And there's steps on the phone. I didn't know I could check my steps.
Yeah, you can.
So
that's not very far. That's pretty slovenly, Cliff.
Yeah, that's true. I got a few notes here, but I'm not going to bother talking about them because.
I wanted to ask you.
We should mention Minnie and Laraz, I suppose. Is that it at the Fairfax? Written by Lely Katz.
Oh, no, I don't know about that.
Director Anne-Louise Sarks, and it's got Nancy Hayes, Sue Jones and Virginia Gay, I think it is.
Cliff,
I three just old dears.
I just wanted to ask you, have you followed the French election at all?
Yes.
Yeah, did you see Macron, who's 39 and is married to his ex-drama teacher who's 64?
Yes, I was very jealous.
And I read in The Age also, I was reading in the Café, I think it's a horrible paper, that was a very good paper, it's now not so good. They were talking about how if that had been in Australia and had been the opposite sex, if he'd been him, he'd been the 64-year-old and she, mm-hmm. the 15-year-old, they would have been put in jail. And that even now, that even if as a man and a woman, he would have, they would have been put in jail for the same thing.
Yes, they're erratic.
I couldn't believe that they're actually talking about this in Australia.
Yes,
that here's this young man who's, this wonderful, with this wonderful woman who's proven, said to her when he was 15, I'm going to marry you and I'm going to be the president of France. Right on two counts. And that she said, no way. And in fact, they're still together. I think it's a wonderful story. But the fact that people could be saying this in the letters, it makes you think, what are they going on?
Why are they even bloody well talking about it?
Yeah, I went to school in the 40s, of course. We didn't have any attractive teachers.
No. Didn't you?
Otherwise you would have married one of them.
No, otherwise I would have got excited sort of sexually a lot younger. But that wasn't the case.
Well, we had nuns, so there was none of that going
and
on.
And I have great admiration for anybody that goes for his teacher, whether they're 40 or 50 years old. I've got nothing against all that stuff. It's nonsense. No. But the French are erratic in some of their choices. I mean, they barred that blonde girl from playing in their open tennis match. She was put out for a year with drugs.
Sharapova?
Yeah, Maria.
Yeah, Maria.
Her name? And,
she wasn't given a wild card. Was the thing.
Yeah, she did her time, for God's sake. Let her come back in.
Well, no, because they said that she's earned her, she's been around, she's made billions, and there were some young players who were poor and struggling and ambitious, and they thought they'd give it to them. I agree.
That's the official reason. Real reason is they don't like her.
No, well, I don't like her grunting either. I'm sorry. She's got lovely legs, but her grunting's really teeny.
Yeah, she's probably a celebrity par excellence sort of thing, and she's a pain in the neck, I know.
Yeah.
But I personally think she should have been allowed to play because a lot of people like to watch her. She makes a lot of noise, but
she
still
does, yeah.
And it's
just turn off
good
the sound.
For the old fellow, it's my age, sort of thing.
It's true. Well, I'm getting there too, Cliff.
I'm very keen on legs. So, yeah, nothing else in the female body sort of attracts me except the eyes and the legs.
Right.
I talked to a young blonde girl last night at Baja.
Did she have eyes and legs?
I was intrigued by the thing in her nose and the thing on her ear. And I talked to her for about 15 minutes, but I made sure I looked her in the eye and I told her she looked gorgeous. See, and that's another thing, John, about picking up girls.
Mm-hmm.
By all means, look them in the eye. By all means, say they have beautiful eyes. And by all means, at some stage, at the appropriate stage, put in a compliment. You're halfway there.
Mm.
Right. Okay, that's good.
There you go. Do you know George Bernard Shaw also said he wakes up in the morning and feels like he's 25 and he looks in the mirror and he says, who's that 75-year-old guy in the mirror there?
Yeah. This is I read all his stuff.
Yeah, he's good, but George Bernard Shaw. He wasn't afraid to be politically incorrect.
He had no sort of superstitions.
So did he write it as Pygmalion or did he write it as
Fair Lady? He wrote it as Pygmalion.
Yes, and then it was adapted. My Fair Lady. Yes.
Adapted, right. And then Lena and Lowe, I assume, put in all the songs and so on.
Yes.
I don't know, but I just thought it was a beautiful piece of music.
I'm amazed theater. I didn't even know it was on, actually, at the Regent Theatre.
And Away's on at the Malthouse.
I was talking about that earlier. It finishes tonight.
Tonight?
Yes, I saw it, actually.
Well, I was in the first one in Melbourne in 1986, January 1986. And when I read the thing on the computer, they put in all the credits from the first production. They were wrong.
They didn't include you?
No, well, they put in, I forget who they put in. They put in Evelyn Crape, whereas Anne Phelan played that part, not Evelyn Crape. And they also put in John Wood, whereas, I forget who played that part, but it wasn't John Wood. But that's okay. And they didn't put me in. Why would they put me in? I'm just a small part player from Northcote,
Actor, blogger, critic and more.
Oh, they'd be regretting it now, though, Cliff.
I'm a bit of a celebrity at the Rye RSL smoking section. What more can you want? And I've got a nice view every morning when I wake up. I can look out and look at the car park. It's lovely. I've got the lot. Yeah.
I was speaking of John Wood. There's a play that he is in that is coming to Frankston Art Centre.
It's probably a production company play, is it?
Yeah, I'm not sure, actually.
Yeah, go on.
It's called Bakersfield Mist by Stephen Sacks.
Right.
It's a story it's a true story of an American woman who buys a painting in an op shop somewhere or somewhere for a few dollars and then comes to believe that it is a Jackson Pollock.
Right.
And gets a guy who's an art critic from New York to come down and assess it. And the play is about that. Anyway.
Who's in it apart from John Wood?
Julie Nile. I never know how to say her name. Is it Nile?
Yeah, well, I never know either. Nil, I suppose.
Nil. Yeah,
she's good.
Okay.
She's a good actor.
So it's obviously come from another production company and come into Frankston Art Centre on the 6th of June. So I'm sure if you go to the Art Centre, you will have a look at it. The Telegraph have said of it that it was inspired by true events, and it's a great comedy that asks vital questions about what makes art and people truly authentic.
So it's not a comedy, it's a drama.
It's a play.
Yes, yes. But
makes it worth going to see.
Well, not necessarily. Picasso had a painting in it. I did 200 shows with that painting up the back.
All right, well, I would just like to say...
We argued a lot about...
Picasso to play. Were you Picasso in that?
No, I was a drunk.
Hey, we've got to roll up. I don't think we've even got time for Cliff's music now, have we, Brody?
No,
we haven't. So we're going straight on to the news. But I need to finish what I was saying before about the FAC, because it's about time that they began respecting writers. They too often omit writers' names in their listings. It's not always, but it's very often. And I suspect that they may be in breach of their license agreement by not doing so. They are an institution dedicated to presenting the arts, and they are neglecting their duty if they do not give warranted respect to the artists who create their work. I've seen it happen too often. Their year program that they had, when they're talking about all the productions that are coming through, they didn't mention writers' names. It's not okay. I think they're giving a very poor industry practice to their work. Pick up your game, FAC.
Most people don't give a damn who wrote the
story. Well, I just think that they should be. So anyway, that's my little bit.
They're more interested in the actors than they are the writers.
No, I'm always interested in the writers, and I agree with everything Sally just said. People are just interested in the story. A bit of entertainment.
Yeah, well, that's not okay.
And the actors.
But they're only interested in the actors if it's somebody they know.
They know, or if someone, or if they've got a certain attribute they like. But the thing about the writers, Sally, is that they get it eventually. You know, they're the ones, it's like the people who write songs. They're not the ones who, people talk about the ones who are singing it, not the ones who are writing it.
Well.
Look at Elvis Presley, didn't write a song, couldn't write him.
It's true, but don't you think in the listings of an art institution like the Art Centre, they should actually be saying, here's the play, and even as a byline underneath it, who wrote it? Surely it's part of their agreement.
If they were efficient and...
they should be. Frankston Art Centre, pull up your socks. We've just about run out of time. How long have we got, Brody? We've got half a minute, so I'm not going to be able to tell you anything. There's lots of things out there.
The opposite of wild.
Yeah, opposite of wild, that's right. John Cecil's opened up a new gallery at Poff's Restaurant for lithographs, some prints. Music on the Hills is coming up this Friday, and Bakersfield Mist is on at the FAC.
Did you go to John Cecil's, Sally?
I did. We'll talk about that soon, because I'm going to get him to come in and talk to us.
Okay.
Yeah, that's Lloyd Rees Landscapes and Lithographs. Yeah. If you've just tuned in, you've missed Arts About. But you can catch up with the show via podcast, which should appear on the station website sometime in the future. The show is also repeated on air and streaming Wednesdays at 12. You can find a link to our Facebook page on the RPP website. Join us again 11 a.m. next Sunday. And remember, everybody, we may not know everything about art.
There's a full moon sculpture walk in McClelland.
Yeah, there is.
Why isn't this streaming live on Facebook right now?
Don't know.
We'll talk to...
Great to see you, Cliff.